Hi, I'm Dr. Swathi Mohan. I'm a NASA Aerospace Engineer with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and you are listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
My name is Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with talented and interesting individuals linked to the global Indian and South Asian community. It's informal and informative, adding insights to our evolving cultural expressions, where each person can proudly say, "Trust me, I know what I'm doing." Hi, everyone. On this episode of Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing, we share a chat with aerospace engineer and scientist at NASA JPL, Dr. Swathi Mohan. Stay tuned. I can't say it enough, so I'll say it again. Thank you for listening to the show and for rating and kindly reviewing it and following on social media. It's very much appreciated, and I'm certainly quite grateful. Now, how often have you looked up in the sky and stared into that deep expanse of what's out there? Gazing into the stars and the vastness of space, and thinking and studying both about what we can see and also what we could possibly see, has been among humanity's first instinctive curiosities, from both our earthly context and everything extraterrestrial. Whether you're looking on a clear night or through the lens of a telescope, it's a reminder of how large the universe is out there, and perhaps how small we indeed are in the totality of time and energy and existence of it all. And so it was really wonderful to catch up with Dr. Swathi Mohan, someone whose experience as a space scientist is helping us better understand how to tackle this exploration, and not just designing and mapping out how to get there, but what did we learn along the way, and what questions we should be asking ourselves to unlock some of those most thrilling and deepest mysteries of outer space. Swathi is an Indian American who, after some inspiration from a great physics teacher in high school, found her way into the world of aerospace engineering. She graduated from Cornell, and after a brief stint working at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory on the Cassini mission to Saturn in 2004, received her PhD in aeronautics and astronautics from MIT, working on the SPHERES project for her thesis, and also helping the initial trial of the Zero Robotics program. She then rejoined NASA and JPL in 2010 in the Guidance, Navigation, and Controls, or GNC section. Since then, Swathi has worked on a number of missions such as the GRAIL project, Mars 2020 Perseverance, and Psyche. Now, I don't know if you remember during the pandemic how we were all locked onto the Mars Perseverance landing, but Swathi was the voice and face of entry, descent, and landing for Perseverance trip to Mars on February 18th, 2021. Recently, she was the GNC lead and a chief engineer for the Psyche mission that launched October 13, 2023, on a journey to a unique metal-rich asteroid orbiting the Sun between Mars and Jupiter. So we had a chance to catch up and chat about everything from problem-solving to representing her cultural heritage to relating how big visionary thinking of space science and aeronautics actually matters to us every day. But we started by chatting about perhaps the most important piece of inspiration that guided Swathi's interest. I'm of course talking about Star Trek: The Next Generation, and as a doctor, I asked her the very pressing question of who's more preferred, Crusher or Pulaski?
Oh, Crusher, absolutely. I mean, I liked Pulaski, but I'm old school and like Crusher. Actually, I was listening to Gates McFadden's podcast, and she talks about why she was removed from that season and then brought back eventually, which I thought was super cool about how she was able to argue for herself and for her character.
So, I mean, I know the Star Trek experience maybe made the sort of interest and the spark of that interest more tangible, but what were some of the things earlier on, perhaps, that really inspired you to seek and explore and perhaps remain, you know, not just with space science, but just remain curious? Were there experiences or perhaps, you know, nuggets along the way that really kind of piqued that curiosity bone for you?
Yeah, the Star Trek really ignited it, I would say. My parents say I was interested in it even before that, but that's the first memory I have. My cousin tells a story of we were playing Pictionary. I was a 5 years old or something like that. And the question came up of Jupiter. And she remembers me being able to draw the planet with the big red spot with perfect accuracy that, you know, a 14-year-old can actually decipher immediately what the planet was. And as a 5 year old, and I have no memory of this, but there were seeds there. And the visions in Star Trek, the the physical descriptions that they had and their ability to make you see really sparked both the curiosity in what was out there and fundamentally how little we know about or could know about the universe that we lived in. So that really sparked me trying to understand and originally trying to journey to these places that maybe were cooler or better than the one that we lived on. So I went to the library and I used to check out books. I would go to the little space sector of the library, the two shelves that they had, and I worked my way through all the books. And every book was more interesting and more factual, whether it was the Red Planet on Mars or whether it was Europa or the Big Bang Theory. It kind of all stepped up and kept me interested and reaching for the next book. I would say where it pivoted into an actual career for me was when I went to space camp. So my parents, after much asking, they finally agreed to let me go to space camp, which is a non-trivial thing, right? Like, we didn't live anywhere near space camp. Like, I had to fly there by myself. Like, it's super expensive for a week, and we weren't super wealthy. We were average middle class. So for them to agree to foot the bill for the whole week was a huge gift in my mind and a huge honor. But when I got there, it was just amazing to be with a community that was as excited about space as I was, and everything about it, from the lectures, which people would think are the boring parts, but about the space history and how things were built, to the hands-on, like, make-believe that we got to do, was just like out of this world. I remember a feeling. They do a simulation as part of the space camp where your team splits into three, and then there's a group in mission control, a group in, like, that's in space as the payload specialist and in space as the mission specialist. And going in, I thought, like, I want to be an astronaut. Like, it's going to be so much fun to play the role in space as opposed to the one that's in mission control. But I went into mission control when it was my rotation. And I remember putting on the headset and holding the binder. And there was just something about that feeling of sitting in the chair, putting the headset on and holding that binder and knowing that you're going to direct what's going to happen in space, that felt very, like, at home to me. And that kind of changed it from a fun hobby curiosity to maybe there's something there that I can actually contribute to. What would it look like? This role in mission control is a job, right? It's a real job that I can aspire to. And what would it take to get there?
I'm imagining that before space camp, and a lot of your sort of curiosity and your exploration was based on the things that you yourself were imagining and learning and being curious about. And I'm wondering if space camp kind of put it in perspective of what's it like to actually collaboratively be in that sort of zone and now be with other people who are just as jazzed about it as you are. And in the context, obviously, of, you know, a little bit more serious of a discussion. You know, it's interesting that love probably blossomed during that week. How old were you at the time, by the way?
I was 16. So I was probably the oldest I could be for space camp without like jumping to the adult space camp, which is a completely different experience.
Oh, wow. I didn't even know there was an adult space camp.
Yeah, there is. It's on my bucket list to go with my kids to do a family space camp. That would be one.
There you go. Well, yeah, I mean, did it feel that sort of like joy of sitting in the control room and understanding sort of like what kind of a role that was? And obviously that made for a wonderful pivot to thinking about it as a career. But did it feel very, like you said, at home? Does it still feel like that?
It does.
Yeah.
It now has the reality to it. So the stress and the technical part of it, as opposed to just the joy, but it's still there. Right. Like, the when things go right and you're able to see it and you're the first ones there in mission control, there's a definite passion, because that's where all the information comes first. All the new information of these spacecraft that are exploring far reaches of our solar system or even our galaxy, it comes through there first. And to be the first ones to see it, to know that you're controlling the vehicle that's out there, is super exciting to me. even though the day-to-day, like, there's a lot of waiting and there's a lot of, you know, analyzing, so it's not as action-packed as they have you believe on the movies, but it's still exciting. Right.
Do you remember your first day as a NASA employee, a JPL employee? I mean, like, in that first moment that you sort of stepped into the kind of giant atmosphere of at least just NASA and the, I wouldn't say bureaucracy of it, but the institution of it.
I do. I started as an intern first at Caltech working with JPL, and then as an intern at JPL, but in a very siloed, very small science group. My first day as an employee was on the Cassini mission right after I had graduated from undergrad.
Yeah.
And, you know, they showed me, Cassini was actively flying, right? So my cubicle was in the mission control building. So it had all these badge access to get from floor to floor. So they took me on a tour. And every time you go up from floor one to floor two, you pass the darkroom, you pass mission control at JPL, yeah. Which was super cool. But it was also, I attended my first meeting and it was like being in a foreign country. The amount of acronyms that were used, like I didn't understand anything that they were saying because the only words that were not acronyms were the, of, which,
right.
And it, they gave
it's
me
kind of like being in the medical ICU, by the way. I'm imagining it's the same sort of thing. Yeah.
Everything is shorthand. Everything is acronyms. And they have these long discussions with all these acronyms. And you can't, you can tell the tone of it, but you can't tell what's actually going on or where or what the problem is. And I got this acronym list, which was not complete and halfway not helpful because there were acronyms that had multiple meanings, like the same acronym, depending on context, was used for three different things. So it definitely felt like I knew nothing, like a fish out of water, had to learn a language, had to learn how to do anything, right? Like I was straight out of undergrad, so had no real skills other than how to learn. So like took a lot of notes and just sat and listened for a long time before.
But brimming with excitement, I imagine.
Brimming with excitement, yes.
Yeah. You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, let's come back to our conversation with Dr. Swati Mohan. Stay tuned. Conversation. It's the antidote to apathy and the catalyst for relationships. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, this is Vidya Balan, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hi, I'm Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, and you are listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with aerospace engineer, Dr. Swati Mohan.
And from that point to like all that you've done now and all you've participated with, I mean, with each successive sort of project and mission and collaboration, even though they might be different in scope and purpose, is there something sort of additive for you, especially when you're problem solving? As you know, like your first moments in that kind of foreign environment with all the acronyms, those are all probably, you know, completely familiar to you now, obviously, but, you know, each of the Cassini versus, you know, some of the Perseverance stuff to some of the Psyche stuff now, I mean, like, is each mission and is each project somewhat additive in building in your skill set as you go forward in your career?
Absolutely. Each mission that I've done, though the field has been relatively similar, the role and the contribution has been varied, starting from in Cassini, it was a very small role. I was mostly like a documentarian of trying to resolve paperwork type of agreements and issues. On Grail, I was doing like navigation. So actually like determining where the spacecraft is, but I wasn't the one coming up with the plan or the lead. I was basically told what to do and I would execute it. And I had, you know, my contributions of a particular calibration or a particular analysis that was mine to figure out. So, but it was small in the vast scheme of the mission. In Mars 2020, as in Perseverance as the lead, I was given basically full scope of one area of how to piece together the GNC system. So that one was the first one where I wasn't given a task list. I wasn't given a set of objectives. I was given a role and had to figure out what that role meant and how to divvy up work between people who were the right people to do it. Admittedly, the team was small early on. As the system engineering lead, I think I had two or three people on my team. Yeah. By the end of the mission, 8 years later, as the operations lead, it was 30 that I was managing to actually run that portion of the mission. But it was full stop the entire development cycle of a mission, from blank sheet paper concept to figure it out to turn the bolts on the spacecraft, get the bits down, understand what it does, like everything in between. So that had a lot of depth to it and a lot of integrated understanding to get from point A to point B to point C. With Psyche, and it was technical contribution. It was all technical, right? Like I was writing code in the test bed. I was actually like doing analysis scripts. I was writing procedures, things like that. In Psyche, it was a GNC lead role. So I actually had no technical contributions, but it was when I joined, the team was behind schedule and unable and had some serious technical challenges in order to meet the schedule. So it was very organizational challenges. How do you restructure a team? How do you motivate? How do you keep to a schedule in a critically schedule driven constraint in order to make progress and get to a risk posture that you can launch? So it was a lot of negotiating, a lot of team dynamics, organization metrics tracking, a lot of making the hard decision of when is good enough, what needs to be looked at, what doesn't need to be looked at, who to put on what job to actually get it done, how do you tell them that given all of the like turf battles or experience. A lot of these personnel skills convolved with the management, which was almost entirely different than what I did on 2020. On 2020, it was all technical, like do what you need to do, here are the people, I'll give you the task. But here it was very integrated and so schedule driven that it took a lot of personalities and people management in to get it to work.
Mm. Let me ask you this. I mean, certainly you hear a lot of pride in that, and you know, that's natural to come with such experience. You were the voice and the face of the Perseverance landing. And how did that particularly resonate for you as an Indian American?
It was an honor to be chosen. And I do remember before being selected, making comments within the team to my friends that, you know, we've had multiple missions, right? Of the five landings that we've had. We've had, you know, a white male, we've had an Asian male, we've had a white woman. I remember thinking, wouldn't it be great if we could have a woman of color, right? That kind of caps off and shows how diverse JPL is. Because we had a plethora of people on the EDL team of all different ethnicities, all different walks of life. Sure. So it wasn't that didn't exist, that there wasn't a pool to choose from. But I remember thinking that that's what we needed, right? To show the world that the institution is diverse, to highlight that in a global way. I don't think that had anything to do with why I was selected. And if you ask the EDL lead, he will say multiple times that had nothing to do with why I was selected. But I remember thinking that would be a nice thing to happen.
And that's right. It's a good important point to remember, right? That like as a scientist and as someone who's dedicated and loyal and fiercely loyal to the science, you know, it's all completely agnostic to the outer appearance of who's driving it. You know, I imagine though that particularly data and innovation, I mean, obviously shouldn't resonate any differently for any particular nationality or ethnicity and that sort of thing. And yet it was important that everyone saw you wearing a bindi on global television. You know, it's on your profile photo. It's what you're wearing right now. How do you merge those concepts that, like, yes, it didn't matter who was the face of it, and yet you were very proudly, in many ways, presenting who you are as the face of these projects?
Yeah, I was very surprised at how much attention the bindi got afterwards. It was a conscious choice for me that day. Not that I wanted to make a statement or anything like that, but I had been raised to wear it, to appreciate what it meant for my culture and for my religion. My mother was very insistent on growing up. So I had gotten used to it being a part of my identity. So when I look in the mirror, I don't feel complete or completely put together if I don't have it on. Similarly, the way you'd feel like if you just rolled out of bed and you look at your face in the mirror, right? You're not completely put together. So in any big event or function, like, it's part of my routine to, you know, when I put on my makeup, I put on my bindi to feel put together. And that day, above all days, I wanted to be as put together as I could possibly be. It wasn't a surprise to anybody in Mission Control, right? It's part of my identity. They've seen it, like, day in and day out for years. Most of them have come to my house for Diwali parties or celebrated it with me. So it wasn't a statement to them either. It was just all of us being our authentic selves and feeling comfortable with the people that we're in to be our authentic selves. And that's really, I think, what made it such a unique team to work with, because it had that layer of trust with everybody working together, that you were free to be your authentic self and openly communicate between each other without fear of being shut down. And in that environment, it became a very positive thing, especially during the pandemic, that we had to lean into that trust and those conversations. So wearing the bindi was a way of representing my authentic self for a momentous occasion where we all wanted to be as authentically ourselves to celebrate and to get through this momentous day together.
I know that this probably is true for every successful accomplishment, but did you feel any particular kinship with your colleagues when the Chandrayaan lander hit? I mean, did that at all resonate any differently for you, again, given this background of being authentic in who you are and maybe the kinship to your identity and your culture?
I did feel some kinship. I think similar to how I would feel for a JPL mission that I wasn't personally working on or knew people on, but was able to celebrate, or another NASA mission, maybe more so than a ESA or JAXA mission. It's nice to follow, to be able to see the threads progress there also.
Yeah. You're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. After a quick break, let's come back to our conversation with aerospace engineer and scientist at NASA's JPL, Dr. Swati Mohan. Every story told is a lesson learned, and every lesson learned is a story waiting to be told. I'm Abhay Dandekar, and I share conversations with global Indians and South Asians so everyone can say, trust me, I know what I'm doing. New episodes weekly, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Krish Ashok, author of Masala Lab, The Science of Indian Cooking, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tam France.
Hey, this is Samir Gadia.
Hi, my name is Richa Morjani, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing with Abhay Dandekar.
Hi there, I'm Abhay Dandekar, and you're listening to Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Let's rejoin our conversation now with aerospace engineer, Dr. Swati Mohan.
I wanted to ask you one thing. I mean, it's a little bit different topic, but
AI is absolutely changing so much in many, many different ways. How particularly is it changing or driving the field you're in? And especially from some of the work that you do that is, as we've talked about so far, it's so human-based. It's such relation. There's so many relationships that are involved there. There's a lot of real intricacy to building a team. And yet, you know, with the, you know, sort of acceleration of, you know, this kind of new driver or this kind of new tool, what's the impact that you see now and maybe in the future of how this might change that kind of dynamic?
Yeah, so there's two aspects of that question from my field in particular, because the my field of controls and automation, like AI, is somewhat of an extension of that field, right? So the more sophisticated we get with automation, the more efficient our spacecraft actually. So we're doing things that are encoding that automation in to allow us to land in more challenging terrains, to operate missions more efficiently longer so that they can actually go to farther places, or that we can do more missions. So there's a there's an aspect of that that's really technical that we're leaning in to enable a new class of missions, be it to more complicated missions or to make it cheaper or easier to get more missions. So there's that part, which is really great, because that unlocks, it unlocks knowledge, it unlocks science that we can't get to right now, but is maybe suddenly has become feasible for the next 5 years or for the next 10 years.
Right.
There's the other aspect of it that is replacing maybe things that had to be done manually that now can be done by automation. Similarly, in the way that people used to hand code calculations and you'd have human computers, that now the computers do all of the different calculations. What do the peoples do?
Yeah.
The at the core of it, the more we replace the base functions and teach the computer how to do it, the part that's remaining is the imagination, right? That's what the humans do, of figuring out what we want to do, why we want to do it, and how we're going to do it. And then once you get to the how, you get to the what it is after figuring out those three things, then you can kind of ship it off and tell someone, sell someone something to build it, and you get it back. But that the part that's remaining is figuring out what we, why we want to do it, what it is, and figuring out the intent of it. So then you can get other people to build it for you. Right now, I mean, NASA does that regularly, right? They put out contracts for specific things of, we want a spacecraft that goes here, does XYZ, like is within this power budget constraint. And then they give it off to someone else to build, whether it's Lockheed Martin or JPL. And it's that, except now tenfold.
Right, right. Just the scope of that and the magnitude probably is just a lot different. You know, you were the guided navigation control lead and chief engineer for the Psyche mission. And I was just thinking a little bit about what you mentioned with, you know, the people imagining. And, you know, that mission has some wonderful discoveries linked to it, and thinking of planet formation and metal cores and testing different technologies. And yet, for so many global citizens, whether they're here in the US or abroad, these concepts and this work may seem so removed from their own like reality and their own day to day. And I'm just so curious, like, how do you personally help bridge this gap of thinking sometimes where like people see you and you're navigating the landing on Mars, people hear about your work and there's a new laser technology being tested, but yet for them, they may not necessarily think in this world, right? And how do you actually narrate these stories to help increase the relatability of your work?
Yeah, with space science in general, you have to be able to look not just 1 week or 1 month or 1 year in the future. You're looking at what knowledge are you building that you can capitalize on in the future? What technologies yeah. are you creating that you can capitalize on in the future? When you build satellites, when we built the Apollo mission, the technologies that came out of that were not things that were necessarily foreseen. The whole computer revolution to miniaturize computers, they originally were created, they would take up huge rooms. The whole goal to miniaturize computers so that they could fit on the spacecraft was, you know, heavily influenced by needing to have a small computer on Apollo. And that sparked this whole revolution to get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, that enabled cell yeah. phones, that enabled computers, that enabled drones, like all this sort of automation that we could have never foreseen back then. Everything from some of the watches that we wear to disposable diapers to different types of pens
yeah.
to GPS satellites that now use to locate everything instantaneously. These are all born out of technology that was created originally to solve a problem in space, or to create a technology in space that then came back and had benefits. So there's one aspect of all of the money that you spend doing this is not spent in space, right? The money that you spend doing this is spent here on the ground. The technology that you learned is spent here on Earth to help eventually yeah. comes back and helps people here. The science that comes out of it advances human understanding that we don't yet know how far it will take us or when it will be necessary. For Perseverance, the base goal, the base science question that we're asking is, are we alone in this universe? Perseverance's mission is to seek the signs of past life, to collect samples that we think may have the fossil remnants of life elsewhere on Mars. That in and of itself is a huge discovery if we're able to make that. It is a society changing discovery to be able to definitively say we on Earth are not the only life in this planet. And once you change the mindset in something like that, once you change the societal mindset with proof, what it unlocks in the human potential of where you go, how you explore, what you can do with that is immense, right? Star Trek has a little nugget of this, where the first contact between Vulcans and humans at the end of the Third World War in Star Trek, that proof that we are not alone in the universe is used to imagine that it erases world hunger. It erases divisions between countries, between nations. It unites the Earth in a global peace that sets them off for exploring the solar system as one body, right? And I mean, that's a fictionalized imagination, Gene Roddenberry's imagination of what that proof of that we are not alone in the universe could trigger in the human society. And those are all wonderful things. Even being able to have these technologies to live on another planet, to live on Mars or to live on the moon, you'll need the technologies like the laser comm that's on Psyche, where you can beam video back from space. The 20% of the entire Cassini mission in a few hours was successfully transmitted. These are the type of technology that you need to eventually move past being confined to the Earth and system. And once you're able to unlock that, we don't yet know what magnitude of changes that can mean for the human society.
I'm listening to all of this, and of course, it's great to relate it back to Star Trek completely. But on top of that, I mean, it reiterates the idea of, you know, such much more expansive thinking, right? That like things are really working 10, 15, 20, 30 years in advance. And also that these technologies, these discoveries, this kind of work is being done on the ground and has really immense application to humanity, not just consumers, but I'm really just, you know, the impact is so large. And with that, I'll get you out of here on this. I mean, the idea that there are concrete things, concrete problems that we're trying to solve, and yet there's so much, obviously, in this incredible expanse of work that is just unsolved. And so this work, from the initial sparks of what Star Trek meant to you, to Space Camp, to your journey through JPL and NASA and all the other things that you've worked on, what is space science and aerospace engineering in general, but what has this all taught you about ambiguity and how to deal with that?
We fundamentally cannot know everything. Any one person, though they may be an expert in something, they're not an expert in everything. And to me, the real exploration or pushing the boundaries comes when we work together. And every push or every inch that we move that curtain aside, we unlock a new piece of the universe, a new piece of the puzzle that helps us imagine what the full picture looks like beyond it. I guess I'm okay living with the ambiguity, because there's a promise or there's a hope that eventually we'll get to the full picture, and that full picture will be beautiful. And the process itself of working together to do that is the journey and is the value that we get out of it.
Well, that hope, that promise, the journey, it, you know, experiencing it all together and certainly keeping up with your accomplishments is something I think we're all enjoying. So I thank you so much for joining us. This was really a treat, and congratulations on it all. I hope we can visit with you again down the road.
Thank you. It was super fun to be able to talk with you like this.
And you can check out more about Swati and her work at drswatimohan.com. Again, a big thank you for rating and reviewing and passing the word along to your friends and family about Trust Me, I Know What I'm Doing. Remember to please be fiercely kind to the planet and maybe deliver a random act of kindness to a neighbor or a friend along the way. Till next time, I'm Abhay Dandekar.